Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's November 29th. I'm laughing because that means next time will be December. It's really hard to imagine. And we're going to start cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure today. Probably have another lecture on that next week. All right, maybe one lecture on respiratory, one lecture on renal physiology, no lecture on diversification system, unfortunately. But I still intend to have those chapters on the last test. Okay. And since I can't go over this diversification system with you, probably not even at all, then just make sure you know the answers to the back of the chapter questions and the figures. And I don't know how many figures there are. They're very few. There's maybe only one figure in chapter 20. Okay? Chapter 18 will not be on the test. It won't be on the test. So that's all I know at the moment. I'm going to try to condense some of these other lectures without just leaving you in the dust. I hope I don't do that. All right, so let's start cardiac output. All these chapters are just too important and fun. All right, so here is chapter 14. I have, as I set up over here, I guess I have a question, and that is, I want to, if anybody knows, see me right after class about requirements for the nursing program here at Cypress College and whether or not the micro class at Cerritos College will qualify as medical micro here. Does anybody know? It does? I mean, it should, right? Because all micro classes and physiology and anatomy classes have been standardized across California, maybe not out of state, but at least within state. So I think that's looking good. Okay. Yeah? Okay, that's nice. But double-check for sure. Yeah. Okay, so let's get on with cardiac output, blood flow. Okay, so we're going to look at cardiac output, define it. So we're going to look at the heart, some properties of the heart. We'll look at some mathematics involved with blood flow in various parts of your body and how that influences blood pressure. Okay, so cardiac output. I don't think I've defined this for you before, all right? But cardiac output is the volume of blood pumped per minute by each ventricle. And I think last time I said that the cardiac output of the right ventricle in a relatively short period of time should equal the cardiac output of the left ventricle. Because remember that the heart is not really one pump, it's actually how many? It's actually two, right? Because the heart has two sides. It has a right and left side. And if one side is pumping more blood than the other, that means blood is going to pool someplace in your body over time, right? And that side of your body, the pulmonary circulation will get real big, or the systemic circulation will be overloaded with blood, and then you'll just explode like a big blood balloon. So the heart has to, I'm just sort of kidding, but something bad is going to happen. All right, so the cardiac output has to be coordinated between each ventricle. All right, so cardiac output, I think I want to write something on the board. Cardiac output is, and as a matter of fact, I want to write it over here. Cardiac output, I'm going to abbreviate CO, is what we said, blood flow. And flow, the way we measure flow is with a volume per time measurement. Volume per time. And let's see, what's a good volume that we're familiar with? Like milliliters, for instance. Does anybody know what a milliliter is? It is a cubic centimeter. So you kind of have an idea of what a centimeter is like. So it's a cubic centimeter, so it's a volume of blood. And time for cardiac output usually is given in minutes. That's the time, but sometimes it's given in seconds. Okay. The next thing we're going to look at is stroke volume. That's the amount of blood pumped by each beat when the ventricle contracts. All right, so that's the amount of blood. So how would we measure the amount of some kind of fluid? What kind of units would we use? Ah, good. So we have stroke volume. Stroke volume is going to be given in mLs, milliliters. Or you could do liters or some other kind of thing, but mLs is very convenient. Okay, and what about heart rate? What can you tell me about heart rate? How do we measure heart rate? Yep. Beats, heart beats in particular. but I think you all knew that.
Per what? Minute, typically.
Okay. Oh, I see some common things here. Minutes here and minutes over here and cardiac output. It's probably a relationship of some kind. All right, so cardiac output is, let me define my cursor to stay on. Okay, so cardiac output, okay, is the volume of, that's pumped, the volume of blood that's pumped by the heart, we see is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. All right, so we said cardiac output is a volume per time. Let's see if that's really true with the things that we can measure. So we got heart rate times stroke volume. What are the units of heart rate again? Yeah, beats per minute. All right, and stroke volume is what? Yeah, milliliters. Milliliters per what? Every time the heart beats one time. Okay, so I'm going to put beats right here too. There's beats right here too. So these, what do these beats do? They cancel out, and what are you left with? Milliliters per minute. All right, is that similar? Oh, that's exactly what we got for cardiac output, right up over here. All right, so that's how we would figure out cardiac output. And then here's just a random fact for you. There's about 5.5 liters of blood in our circulation, total circulation. Okay, so let's talk about some properties of the heart. Especially, we're going to focus on heart rate. And there's different ways the heart can be regulated. It can be regulated in two ways. One is by the strength of contraction, and one is by the frequency of contraction. We'll adjust cardiac output. Okay, but we're just going to talk about the heart rate right now because we can separate those two influences very easily. So without the influence of the nervous system, you know that the pacemaker of the heart will drive the heart rate at its spontaneous activity. Okay, and what's the real name for the pacemaker of the heart? Yeah, the SA node, and you should kind of have a picture in your mind of where that SA node is. And remember, it has action potentials like a nodal tissue does, and we saw how autorhythmicity is regulated within nodal tissue. And normally, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system influence heart rate, okay, by adjusting the SA node. Okay, and we call that the chronotropic effect of the nervous system. So if we have a chronotropic agent, what's it going to affect on the heart? Is it going to affect the rate or the force of contraction? It's going to be the rate, right? Because that's the parameter involving time. Anytime you see chrono, that's going to directly relate to some kind of time variable. All right, so we have both sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system going to the SA node. And that's the main controller of heart rate. And sympathetic and parasympathetic activity, remember, how would you think of, what's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? Antagonistic to each other, right? And so that's not a futile control. That provides what? Precise control and balance over heart rate because it can modify these spontaneous depolarizations. So let's look at some of these action potentials or depolarizations. At the SA node, all right, and this top trace right here is just voltage versus time, and it's in millivolts. We're used to looking at graphs like this, and we see that there is no stable resting membrane potential, and because it's nodal tissue, it's going to spontaneously depolarize, and you should probably know what kind of channels are in the membranes of nodal tissues inside the cell that allow for this spontaneous depolarization. Does anybody remember? HCN, and what ion is working through an HCN channel? Okay, and it's still sodium. It's a leaky sodium channel. All right, and then when that reaches threshold, then voltage-gated sodium channels open up, okay, and that causes this massive depolarization, and then we know about the usual kind of hyperpolarization, and the cycle starts all over again. And the period of time between each of these peak depolarizations is determined by the slope of what the HCN channels are doing. Okay, so just going to adjust the slope of the slow depolarization period between action potentials. All right, so we could calculate the heart rate if we knew this time scale. Oh, we have it down here, but we're not going to spend time doing that. The second graph over here, now do you see, it's basically the same period of time, Okay, but and how many action potentials do you see now compared to the control? Okay, control had 2 action potentials for that period of time, and this one has 3. All right, so is that a faster heart rate or a slower heart rate? Or the same? Yeah, it's a faster heart rate, and that's what the sympathetic nervous system does. It speeds up the heart. And the way that it does that is that it opens up more HCN channels right here, so the slope of depolarization is a lot steeper, which means that it reaches threshold potential faster, and so we can get more action potentials in that same period of time, right? So the heart is going to beat faster. All right, but that's only one nervous system. What's the second nervous system? Parasympathetic. Goes to the SA node as well, right? And acetylcholine promotes the opening of potassium channels in the membrane. And what's the effect of potassium compared to sodium channels? Sodium will depolarize, potassium will hyperpolarize, right? So the potassium channels will work against the sodium channels, and that will decrease the slope of this automatic depolarization, which then means that there's going to be fewer action potentials developed in that same period of time, and thus slowing the heart rate down. Okay, so this I think is a good exam figure because we can see the effects of sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system on how it can regulate the chronotropy of the heart. Not the force of contraction just yet, but just the rate of contraction. All right, so remember, 2 ways that we can control the heart. One is by adjusting the heart rate, and the other is by adjusting the force of contraction. And we call that inotropy. So force has to do with inotropy, and here we have cardiac output, and we can see that the 2 terms in cardiac output right here was heart rate. This is what the chronotropic term, and stroke volume is the amount of blood that the heart can pump every time it beats, and that's related to the inotropy of the heart, how strong the heart is in terms of pumping blood. So as the heart gets weaker, stroke volume goes down. If the heart is stronger, stroke volume goes up. Okay, so let's look at some effects on inotropy. The cardioregulatory center, is what I like to call it, is in the medulla, and it coordinates the activity of autonomic nerves going to the heart. But it gets good, reliable information from all over your body. We'll look and see what that does. The sympathetic nerve endings go to the SA node, and we're familiar with that. Right, and we just looked at the effect. What would be the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the atria, especially the SA node? What's going to happen to the heart? Yeah, increased heart rate. You see that on the previous slide. But the sympathetic nerve endings also go to the ventricles. And under normal conditions, is there a pacemaker in the ventricles? There's not, right? The pacemaker is up in the atrium, the SA node. Okay, but these sympathetic nerve endings go to the ventricles because it will influence the force of contraction or the strength of contraction. All right, so if something is going to adjust or have an effect on the strength of contraction, or sometimes we call that contractility of the heart, if it's going to affect the contractility or force of contraction of the heart, what kind of agent would that be? Would that be a chronotropic agent or an inotropic agent? It's going to be an inotropic agent, right? Okay, so these sympathetic nerve endings do go to both the atria and both ventricles. And you saw in that previous slide that it has a positive chronotropic effect because it increases heart rate. Okay. And it's also going to increase force of contraction. So let's just look at some of this anatomy. I'm not sure if you can remember this from anatomy, but we have different regions on the heart in the first column. Right, SA node, AV node, atrial muscle, and ventricular muscle. You should kind of remember where those things are. And then, how many divisions are there in the autonomic nervous system? 2, and that shows us the last 2 columns right here. And we see that sympathetic nerves go to the SA node. And you can see what the effect is right here. We talked about it already. Sympathetic nerves also go to the AV node, increasing the rate of contraction. And we just said that sympathetic nerves actually do go to the ventricles as well, and it has a positive inotropic effect on the ventricle, so the force of contraction will be greater under sympathetic influence. All right, now let's look at the parasympathetic nervous system. It does go to the SA node, right? So it has a negative chronotropic effect on the SA node, slows the heart rate down, has the same effect at the AV node, decreases the conduction rate through the AV node into the ventricles. But here's something that's pretty interesting and different, and that's why we made the table. There are no parasympathetic nerves that go to atrial muscle or ventricular muscle. So what does that mean? Does the parasympathetic nervous system have a positive inotropic effect, like the sympathetic nerve does over here on the ventricle, or does it have a negative inotropic effect on the ventricle? That's a nasty trick question, because it has no effect. Parasympathetic nervous system cannot help adjust heart rate whatsoever. Okay, so that's the way it goes. That's too bad. And maybe we'll talk about why that's too bad in just a little bit. Okay, there is a pathology that is epidemic in the United States, and it has to do with blood pressure. And some, and a lot of people have above normal blood pressure. What do we call that? Hypertension. Okay, and one of the reasons why I think hypertension is epidemic is because in a couple places of the body, there's a lot of sympathetic influence, and it's not balanced out by the parasympathetic nervous system. And you just saw one example of that, okay, in the ventricle. Okay, let's talk about some of these variables. Stroke volume, remember that deals with the inotropy of the heart or strength of contraction. And you know how to calculate stroke volume from a Wiggers diagram, right? You would just measure the end diastolic volume and then the end systolic volume, subtract those two, and you would get the stroke volume. So I could give you a Wiggers diagram and ask and not give you the answer, for instance, on the test. So that's one important parameter, right? End diastolic volume of the blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. And that's the large volume. And we're going to see what effect that has on the heart. Total peripheral resistance, that's the impedance to blood flow in arteries. And then also myocardial contractility, strength of contraction. As the strength of contraction gets stronger, what do you think happens to stroke volume? It increases, right? So they're directly related to each other. What do you think happens to stroke volume when total peripheral resistance increases? If the impedance of flow through the arteries increases, all right, then that's going to decrease stroke volume because the heart has to pump harder to maintain blood pressure. All right, let's see how stroke volume is regulated. Well, end diastolic volume is the workload on the heart. Right, that's how much blood is in the heart that the heart has to pump. We call that preload, prior to contraction. And stroke volume is directly proportional to end diastolic volume, or what we call preload. And also contractility of the heart, which relates to stroke volume. Right, so strength of contraction, is directly related to end diastolic volume. And when we're talking about direct and inversely related to something, maybe let's write something out to make sure you know these terms that I'm talking about. So let's talk about blood flow. Blood flow is equal to two parameters, two physical parameters, just two. Okay, and these can then be broken down into other kinds of things. So if we have flowing blood, what does it need to go from compartment A to compartment B? Or why does a molecule move from compartment A to compartment B? If we learn this in terms of understanding diffusion and osmosis, how does it always go for osmosis and diffusion? High concentration to low concentration. Okay, so use that same model in your mind to understand how a fluid flows, whether it's a gas or a liquid, those are both fluids, what's going to be the motivating force for moving that fluid from one place to another? It's going to be pressure, and we can show how that's sort of related to concentration, and it's going to go from high pressure to low pressure. And as the pressure increases, right, let's go back to that diffusion one. If the concentration gradient increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? As the concentration gradient increases, the rate increases, right? So we call that directly related. So blood flow, as the pressure difference increases or as the pressure increases, blood flow is going to increase. Right? It's going to go from high pressure to low pressure. So in this case, if we increase the pressure, we increase blood flow. We say those two terms are directly related to each other. They both go up at the same time. Okay? But there's something that can influence blood flow, and that is the impedance to that, and we call that resistance. The resistance of blood vessels to blood flow is over here, and I hope you can kind of just get an intuitive sense that as the resistance to blood flow increases, what happens to blood flow? So as R gets bigger, what happens to blood flow? We're going to keep P the same. As R gets bigger, what happens to blood flow? It's got to go down. So we say that's inversely related, just like that. Okay, so directly related, anything in the numerator is directly related. Anything in the denominator is inversely related to that parameter. Okay, so that's why we're interested in this resistance. So total peripheral resistance, sometimes we call that the afterload of the heart, because that impedes ejection of blood from the ventricles. All right, but that's just resistance. I wrote it as resistance here. It's written as total peripheral resistance. If we look at all of the resistance to blood flow in the body, then we call that TPR. All right, here's another important clinical index. We call this the ejection fraction. Ejection fraction is defined as the stroke volume divided by the end diastolic volume. And what the heck is a stroke volume again? That is how much blood is pumped by a ventricle every time it beats. Okay, every time the heart beats. And then end diastolic volume is what the initial volume was. So ejection fraction is the percentage of blood that is pumped every time the heart beats. So it's sort of like hematocrit, but right, it has to do with blood flow. It has to do with the amount of blood that is ejected from the heart. Normally it's about 60%, and this is a really important clinical diagnostic tool. It can be used to time surgeries, for instance, if somebody needs a valve repair or some kind of repair on the heart. Okay, if this number starts to decrease or reaches a certain threshold, then that's a good reason to do open heart surgery on somebody. But if it's nice and stable and high and somebody has a heart defect, then why risk surgery, for instance? Okay. So this is an important indicator. It also tells us what the prognosis is going to be for that patient. What is their recovery going to be like? Is it going to be extended or will it be very fast? Right. So this ejection fraction is an important parameter. All right, so let's look at the Starling law of the heart, because you're probably wondering, well, what does end diastolic volume have to do with contractility or inotropy of the heart? All right, the Frank Starling law of the heart is something that talks about the intrinsic control of the heart, not extrinsic, but intrinsic. This is a law that the heart undergoes without any influence from the parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system. It doesn't need innervation. This is just automatically built into the heart, and we'll kind of see why that is. All right, so the Frank Starling law states that strength of ventricular contraction, or we call that inotropy, varies directly with end diastolic volume. That means how much the heart actually stretches, right? How big that volume is. All right, that's an intrinsic property of the heart. And as we can see from this graph of stroke volume versus end diastolic volume, as end diastolic volume increases, going to the right, what happens to the stroke volume? As end diastolic volume goes up, what happens to stroke volume? Well, follow this curve, and let's go over to a small end diastolic volume and read stroke volume. So here we could put a little mark, and then let's increase end diastolic volume and find that over. Is that the same stroke volume or greater or lesser? It is increasing. Okay, so that's how we would read this graph. So we say that end diastolic volume is directly related to stroke volume. If end diastolic volume goes up, that then stroke volume is going to go up under some circumstances, under most circumstances. All right, so we see an increased contractility at a particular end diastolic volume. So let's just say a one end diastolic volume right here. And then here we see a heart under normal conditions. And then let's increase sympathetic stimulation of the heart. What's going to happen to contractility? Even at the same end diastolic volume, it's going to jump up to here. It's going to increase. So contractility increases when sympathetic tone increases. All right, well, let's increase the sympathetic tone of the heart even more, but let's keep end diastolic volume still the same. All right, so let's increase sympathetic activity on the heart, and guess what happens to contractility? it jumps up once again. All right, so sympathetic activity is, in this particular diagram, in terms of the Frank Starling law, what are we considering? Are we considering inotropy or chronotropy? And again, it's inotropy, right? It's force of contraction of the heart. And as the heart gets stronger, the stroke volume increases. Okay, and one of the controlling influences is this end-diastolic volume, which says, recap of this law right here says, that as the ventricles fill with blood, they get more work to do, but something really fascinating about the heart, as it's giving more work to do, what is it able to do? It's able to get stronger and pump that blood out. All right, so that's a really important thing. I'm going to draw this diagram on the board in maybe just a little bit different way. But before I do that, let's go the other way. We said that as the volume of the ventricle gets bigger, what happens to force of contraction if it's directly related? As the volume gets bigger, inotropy increases, right? Now, consider this. What happens if if end-diastolic volume starts to shrink so that the ventricles don't fill up with so much blood? The end-diastolic volume decreases. What happens to contractility? It decreases. And that's really a dangerous situation for somebody that is hemorrhaging. Because if somebody is losing blood, what can you imagine what can happen to end-diastolic volume? If somebody's losing blood, do you think end-diastolic volume goes up or does it go down? Yeah, it's got to go down because you just don't have the same amount of blood. And as it starts to go down, what happens to the strength of the heart? Gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and that's a terrible thing when that happens. Okay, so what would you want to do for a patient that is going into heart failure because their end-diastolic volume is going down? And you can do this on the way to the hospital. You just hook up an IV and get any kind of fluid into their cardiovascular system, like saline, for instance. And as their blood volume increases because of that saline, the IV drip that they have, or maybe they're pushing it in, okay, what happens to the total blood volume? It goes up, and then end-diastolic volume goes up, and how does that help the patient? Force of contraction increases because of this Frank Starling law, or just the intrinsic property of the heart. So that's pretty important. One other thing, all right, so here we have that graph. That's only a partial graph. Right here we got stroke volume, that's contractility, versus what? End diastolic volume, and the curve really kind of looks like this. Okay, so as we increase, and what you see on this graph right here is just in this region of the curve. Okay, so for instance, if somebody has low blood volume, then they have really poor contractility of the heart. If they have normal blood volume, which is usually right about here, okay, they have really good normal contractility on the heart. All right, we can improve that a little bit. Under some circumstances, we can get a little bit more contractility. But look at this circumstance over here. This is usually what we call the ascending limb of the Frank Starling curve. This is the descending limb. All right, so what can you tell me about end-diastolic volume at this descending limb of this Frank Starling curve? What about blood volume? It's way up. Somebody is retaining fluids when this happens. And what happens to a person when they're operating in this part of the Frank Starling curve? What happens to their heart as they get a fluid overload in their body? Their heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and hearts do go into failure when that happens. And one of the first therapies for a patient, and it's almost like a miracle drug, does anybody know what we would give a patient under this circumstance when they're retaining fluids and their heart is being overloaded? We'll see why in a second. Yeah, Lasix. And what's Lasix? It's a diuretic. So they relieve that volume from their body, their blood volume decreases, and what happens to their heart? It gets stronger. Okay, so when you're fluid overload, all right, you give a diuretic. Okay, but what about under, when you have a hemorrhage? Oh, I don't even know how to spell hemorrhage. Too bad I said that. Okay, if there's hemorrhage, blood volume is going down, you need to give fluids. All right, so it all depends on the circumstances. And the way that you know that is by appreciating this Frank Starling law, which is just an intrinsic property of the heart. And I think you're familiar with it already because we looked at skeletal muscle. And you know that cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle is very similar because what's a structural and functional unit for contraction in both? It's a sarcomere, right? So you know how these things work. Not so in smooth muscle, but in the heart and skeletal muscle you do, right? And the strength of contraction, the amount of tension that a sarcomere can develop is dependent on the overlap of actin and myosin filaments, right? So as the optimal overlap of actin and myosin is achieved, then the heart gets stronger and stronger. So we could say that under this circumstance where end-diastolic volume is really low, okay, the heart is not stretching, the sarcomeres are not stretching, right, then this sarcomere really can't contract and produce any kind of tension. All right, so tension is way decreased under these circumstances. And so where would that be? That would be somewhere on this ascending limb of the Frank-Starling curve. Now let's start to stretch the heart out. Now we have nice optimal overlap right here of myosin and actin. It can form many cross bridges, and there's plenty of room for filaments to slide over each other. So this is a condition where the end-diastolic volume is just perfect, and it will produce the most tension within the heart. Okay? And then in your mind, what happens to that sarcomere when we're on this descending limb of the Frank-Starling curve? What happens to the myofilaments? They start to lose their overlap, and then they can't produce that tension, and that's heart failure when that happens, or one of the reasons. Okay, so that's a pretty important slide. So we were talking about that extrinsic control of contractility, right? Inotropic effect on the heart. So, and I showed you this curve sort of already in a little bit different way, but at any given end-diastolic volume, so we're going to look at sarcomeres, and they're all going to be at the same length for this consideration. So end-diastolic, at any given end-diastolic volume, the contractility of the heart depends on the sympathetic tone, how much sympathetic activation is getting from sympathetic nerves. But why do we have adrenal activity here as well? Does the adrenal gland have anything to do with the sympathetic nervous system? Yeah, because the adrenal medulla really is acting like a postganglionic sympathetic nerve fiber. When it is stimulated, it's going to release epinephrine and norepinephrine directly into the blood. And remember, under those circumstances, an epinephrine and norepinephrine is acting like a neural hormone. And that epinephrine and norepinephrine, it says right here, goes everywhere in the body, including the heart. And it can bind to adrenergic receptors in the heart, having a positive inotropic effect on the heart due to an increase of calcium in the sarcomeres. And remember, the cardiac muscle is regulated just like skeletal muscle. Calcium has to bind to a molecule on the actin filament. What does it have to bind to? Anybody remember? It is called troponin. And when it binds to troponin, tropomyosin gets out of the way, and then we have contraction. All right, so here we have length of a muscle as a percentage of optimum contraction. And we can see without epinephrine, okay, it produces relatively little tension, depending on the stretch at a given end-diastolic volume. Okay, but as sympathetic activity increases, the graph shifts to the left, and you have a greater tension developed as a result of that. And then here is a curve for skeletal muscle. It kind of exhibits the same characteristics. As you stretch a muscle, it does get stronger. Skeletal muscle does get stronger up to a point. Okay. So these don't show any of the descending limbs, but clinically I think you can see how important it is. All right, so cardiac output is equal to cardiac rate, which is, well, that's kind of a funny way of saying it. What is cardiac rate? What are you familiar with? Heart rate. Yeah, I like that. Heart rate. All right, so I don't really want to completely erase this blood flow. I did, but I'm going to put it over here. What's blood flow equal to? What is it directly related to? Pressure. As the pressure increases, blood flow increases. What is it inversely related to? Resistance. So I'm going to put this resistance right here. That should probably be burned into your memory, that equation, but it's a real simple equation, okay? Okay, so we have heart rate times stroke volume, and we showed how when you put this together, you get what, milliliters per minute. So what can affect heart rate? What are things that can affect the chronotropy on the heart? This is kind of just a recap. Remember, the parasympathetic nervous system goes to the SA node, so it has a negative chronotropic effect on the heart. Sympathetic fibers go to the SA node, and it has a positive chronotropic effect on the heart. Okay, and his heart rate, for instance, if it's sympathetic nerves going to the SA node and that increases heart rate, what happens to cardiac output? As heart rate increases, is heart rate directly or inversely related to cardiac output? Is it in the numerator or denominator? It's in the numerator. So as heart rate goes up, cardiac output goes up. Okay? All right, what about stroke volume? Stroke volume is controlled by sympathetic nerves. Okay, we just showed that under a couple circumstances. So the force of contraction increases, so the stroke volume increases. But what about parasympathetic nerves? I don't see any arrows going over to stroke volume right here. Why is that? Because parasympathetic nerves don't go to the ventricles. It only goes to the nodal cells in the atria, not the ventricles. Right? So only sympathetic nerves can affect stroke volume. And it increases a contractility, so sympathetic nerves are positive, what, inotropic or chronotropic agent? Inotropic, a positive inotropic agent, because it makes the heart stronger. So that increases stroke volume. So is stroke volume directly related or inversely related to cardiac output? Is directly related. If stroke volume goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It increases. And then also, we just talked about how end-diastolic volume, at least in the ascending limb of that Frank-Starling law, okay, if end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to inotropy of the heart? Oh, I erased it. Okay, but here we have it. Here's the ascending limb. Here's end-diastolic volume. Here's contractility. As we increase the volume, the filling of the heart, what happens to contractility? It increases, so it's directly related. Okay, so as end-diastolic volume goes up, that increases stroke volume, but what's the ultimate effect? Increasing cardiac output, okay, or blood flow from the heart, okay, because contractility is increased. So that's a pretty important diagram. All right, so we saw how important end-diastolic volume is to adjusting these cardiac parameters, cardiac physiology. And we saw how end-diastolic volume is very important, and it works through that the Frank-Starling law. So let's look at end-diastolic volume right here, which is what really related to stroke volume, which is related to cardiac output, and cardiac output is a blood flow. Okay, so we're going to see that cardiac output is going to have an effect on blood pressure through that equation right there. So what influences end-diastolic volume? It's dependent on how much blood is returned to the heart. We call that venous return. All right, so blood volume has an effect on how much blood returns to the heart. So if we decrease blood volume by taking a diuretic, for instance, that decreases blood volume, okay, what happens to venous return? It decreases. All right, so blood volume is directly related to venous return. Okay, tissue fluid volume. If we transfuse fluids into somebody's body, their blood volume goes up. Okay, that increases venous return, that increases end-diastolic volume. The heart fills more. What happens to stroke volume as the heart fills more under normal circumstances? Yeah, stroke volume goes up, and if stroke volume goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It increases too, right? They're all directly related to each other. So a lot of these things are pretty simple once you start to think about it. All right, something else can affect venous return. There's the respiratory pump, which we talked about, right? Anytime you reduce pressure in the thorax, then that's going to have a tendency to suck blood up into the thorax through veins, okay? And then venous return is going to increase. When we exhale, that increases the pressure in the thorax. Why doesn't that push blood back down to the extremities and then your heart will get weaker? How come that does not happen? What prevents retrograde flow of blood in veins? There are valves, that's right. So veins do have valves. So blood can get sucked up when you inhale and it can't go back down to the periphery under normal circumstances when you exhale. We call this the respiratory pump. Okay. The other thing is a skeletal muscle pump. When you contract the muscle, that squeezes a vein. And which way can blood, when you pressurize that blood in a vein, which way does it go? Which way can it go? Can it go two directions? Only one direction. It can only go one direction, which is back to the heart, because why? Veins have valves. All right, so think of the respiratory pump and a skeletal muscle pump helping cardiac output via venous return. And also, venoconstriction. What the heck does that mean? When there's a vein and it constricts. So if you have a dilated vein, we have a bunch of blood just sitting there that's pooled. It's not going through the circulatory system. And then all of a sudden, let's constrict that vein. What are we doing? We're like injecting that big blood volume into the cardiovascular system. So now we have greater venous return and greater cardiac output through these mechanisms that we talked about. And sympathetic nerve stimulation causes venoconstriction. So the sympathetic nervous system, again, increases cardiac output. Okay. Veins hold most of the blood in the body, about 20%. Small veins, large veins. Here is a percentage of how much blood is found in other parts of your body, like the lungs, it's about 10%. We'll find about 10% in the heart. We'll find about 10% in systemic arteries, and maybe 4 or 5% in capillaries, but the rest are in veins. All right, so most of our blood volume is in veins, and most of the time veins are dilated. They're just a reservoir for blood in case you need to increase what? Cardiac output. Then a vein can constrict, and cardiac output will go up. And veins can hold a lot of blood because they are highly compliant. All right, so here it says they're high capacitance vessels. That just means that, let's think of an artery, compare it to a vein. Can you remember what the wall of an artery looks like? It's really thick, it's got a lot of connective tissue, it's got a lot of smooth muscle, right? The muscularis externa has a lot of smooth muscle. So that if we increase the pressure in an artery, right, it's going to dilate, but not very much, because the wall is so strong. But now a vein, if we increase a vein by that same amount of pressure, guess what's going to happen to it? It's going to stretch out a lot more. That's what we mean by a high compliance container or vessel. Veins are more compliant than arteries because with the same pressure, they have a tendency to stretch more as a result. And as a result, blood can be stored in veins very nicely. Okay, let's look at some hormones that affect fluid volumes in your body. And if it affects fluid volumes, what is it going to affect? It's going to affect blood volume, which then affects venous return, which then affects what? The stroke volume on the heart, and how then through that cardiac output equation, you see it can adjust the inotropy of the heart, or how hard what the force of contraction is on the heart. So these hormones right here can adjust cardiac output. All right, so which of the above hormones are synergistic and which are antagonistic? What would you like to see? Would you like to see some antagonism in these hormones right here? Or is it better just to have them all working together in a synergistic way? Okay. Synergistic or antagonistic? What about the autonomic nervous system? What's that like? What about the biceps brachii and triceps brachii? And would you like to have one without the other? No. Because why? Of antagonism. Okay, what about in your car? Would you like a gas pedal and a brake pedal, or would one suffice for you? What happens if you only have a brake pedal? Well, you're not going to get home. What happens if you only have a gas pedal? You can get home, but what? You can't stop. All right, so what can you tell me about antagonism? Would you look forward to it in a physiologic control system or no? Absolutely. So guess what? There is antagonism in the hormonal control of the heart as well. Okay, so still, you're going to have to go back through lecture and tell me which ones are synergistic and which ones are antagonistic, but you should welcome that information because it provides for precise control and balance. Okay, the first one, ADH. Anybody know what ADH stands for? Antidiuretic hormone. Where does it come from? The pituitary gland, and indeed it's the posterior pituitary. There's only one other hormone that comes from the posterior pituitary, and that is oxytocin. Okay, So ADH is released, all it says right here, released from the posterior pituitary. Okay, so I could check up on you guys when you said that. Okay, when osmoreceptors detect high osmolality, what the heck does that mean? When water concentration goes down and solute concentration goes up, that means then it gets very salty. Your blood gets very salty as a result. Now, how could your blood get very salty? Drinking too many margaritas that have salt on the rim would be one reason, right? Excess salt intake. Or dehydration, right? Not staying hydrated, for instance, during exercise. And that causes thirst. Right? That stimulates water resorption from the urine. Okay, so ADH release is inhibited by low osmolality. High osmolality increases ADH, and increased levels of ADH gives you the sense of being thirsty. So what would you do to counteract that? You would drink some water, okay? And that will bring the osmolality back to the normal range. That's going to be an effect of antidiuretic hormone, or ADH. Okay, and it's going to stimulate water resorption from urine. You're going to have to think of a nephron. What's resorption? What are the two fluids? What are the two fluids in a nephron? Well, this goes back to anatomy. There are two fluids. Because there are two kinds of elements that make up a nephron. The two elements are vascular elements filled with what kind of fluid? Blood. And tubular elements that are filled with another kind of fluid, but not blood. That's going to be filtrate. Okay, so you have filtrate and blood are the two fluids in a nephron. And antidiuretic hormone allows the kidney to take water from the filtrate and put it back into the blood. And what does that do to urine volume? Because that filtrate eventually ends up in the blood, and then you void that from, the filtrate ends up in the bladder, and then you void that from your body. Okay? So antidiuretic hormone does the reverse thing that a diuretic does. So let's look at this. I'm sure this is an exam figure. All right, so what could cause an increase in blood osmolality? Dehydration, okay, that's going to cause a decrease in blood volume as well. Salt ingestion is going to increase osmolality of the blood. The hypothalamus measures osmolality of the blood all the time, but the hypothalamus is in communication with the pituitary gland, in this case, the posterior pituitary, it says right here. Okay, so as blood osmolality increases, the posterior pituitary is going to increase antidiuretic hormone. And what does that do to body water? Water retention by the kidneys. What does that mean? What happens to water inside your body? If it's retained as a result of a signal from the pituitary, an ADH signal, more water is going to stay in your body. Okay, and that increases blood volume, that decreases what the stimulus was, right? So here is the response, increased blood volume and decreasing blood osmolality. What can you tell me? Is this a negative feedback mechanism or positive feedback mechanism? Negative feedback mechanism, okay, to maintain proper electrolyte concentration in the blood, but probably even more importantly, blood volume, because that's going to affect the contractility of the heart and your cardiovascular system. All right. ADH is also going to stimulate the hypothalamus, will stimulate thirst, because the thirst center is in the hypothalamus, and when you're thirsty, hopefully you can drink something. Hopefully water is available to you, and that's going to increase blood volume, and that's going to decrease blood osmolality. And again, what kind of feedback is that? Nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so in general, what's the effect of ADH on blood volume? It increases. What's the effect of ADH on blood volume and then contractility of the heart? It increases, right? If you increase blood volume, that increases end-diastolic volume. Contractility of the heart increases. And then what happens to cardiac output when that happens? It increases. So I want you to be aware that when contractility of the heart goes up, the pressure goes up too. Okay, so antidiuretic hormone increases blood pressure by increasing blood volume. So just on this slide someplace, you know, put an up arrow and blood pressure, because it affects cardiac output and stroke volume and all of that stuff. Let's look at another hormone. This is aldosterone. Probably aldosterone, you remember, comes from the adrenal gland, adrenal cortex. It's a mineralocorticoid. So it's a secreted by, make sure you know, you don't have to know the layer of the cortex, but you should at least know that it is the adrenal cortex. It helps maintain blood volume, and if it's maintaining blood volume, it's going to have an effect on what? Blood pressure. So this is another important hormone, regulating blood pressure, through reabsorption and retention of salt and water from the urine. So aldosterone is going to have an effect on the kidney, and it's going to cause you to resorb salt from the filtrate to put it back into the blood. Okay? And when that happens, water travels along with it, because water can diffuse down a concentration gradient. So if we make the blood more salty under certain circumstances, then water is going to just diffuse from the filtrate back into the blood through the tubular elements of the kidney. All right, so aldosterone is stimulated by salt deprivation, low blood pressure, okay, and low blood volume. But we know low blood volume will cause low blood pressure. All right, so if aldosterone is stimulated by this, all right, and there's a nice negative feedback mechanism, what's the effect of aldosterone on blood pressure? So aldosterone secretion is stimulated by low blood pressure. Guess what you would expect to be if this is a nice negative feedback mechanism? Once aldosterone is released, what should happen to blood pressure? It should go up. Okay? So put an up arrow over here and put blood pressure. What about antidiuretic hormone? What's the effect on blood pressure there? Yeah, it increases as well. So here we have, now is aldosterone and ADH, are they antagonistic or synergistic? Synergistic. Oh, you're going down the wrong road. That doesn't sound good for your body. Because what would you like to see? Some antagonism in there. Okay, and we're going to get to that in a second. All right, so here is the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. So we're still talking about aldosterone. Remember, that increases blood pressure. The effect of aldosterone increases blood pressure. When there's a salt deficit, low blood volume, or low blood pressure, something called angiotensin II is produced. Right? And so that's a hormone in your body. Angiotensin II causes a number of effects, all aimed at increasing blood pressure. It increases aldosterone secretion. Does that increase blood pressure? Indeed it does. Angiotensin II can increase your sensation of thirst, and then hopefully you have water available to you, and that's going to increase blood volume, increase venous return, which means cardiac output's going to go up. That increases blood pressure, right? And remember, what the stimulus is for this mechanism, one of the stimulus is what? Low blood pressure, okay? And aldosterone, we went through that already. Vasoconstriction. What's the effect on blood pressure there, for instance? Take a balloon, okay? It has a certain volume, and if you're going to constrict the balloon, what are you going to do? Squeeze down on it, and when you squeeze down on it, the volume decreases. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Yeah, it increases, and if you press down really, really hard, what's going to happen to that balloon? It's going to pop, okay? Hopefully that doesn't happen to anybody you know, but vasoconstriction increases pressure, okay? Just think of that kind of really simple way of thinking about it. All right, here's an important exam figure. This is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system in its totality. And what were we really thinking about in the previous slides? What do I want you to key on? Blood pressure, okay? Blood pressure. So the stimulus is a decreased blood pressure or even blood flow through the kidneys. So if blood flow through the kidneys decreases, usually that's a result of low blood pressure. There's a part of the kidney called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. We just introduced this structure to you in anatomy, but don't talk very much about it because you can see it's just a little bit complicated. It can monitor blood pressure and blood flow, right? That's right at the confluence or right at the junction of the distal convoluted tubule and the afferent and efferent arteriole. Right there is the juxtaglomerular apparatus right at the entrance to every nephron, okay? When there's low blood pressure, it's going to release renin into the blood. That little part of the nephron releases renin, and renin is an enzyme. And what does an enzyme do? It speeds up some kind of chemical process. It can convert a reactant into a product that doesn't normally happen. right? So it speeds up that rate. And the product that is produced from renin, because it's called angiotensin 1. I just talked about angiotensin 2 on the previous slide, but here's angiotensin 1, and it's in your blood all the time. It's ready to go to work, but it's inactive because it's stored in a form called angiotensinogen. Anytime you see a word with an ogen on a suffix of that word, that means that it is inactive. And you could probably give me the name of one other kind of protein that's in your body that you make gobs of, but it's inactive, but it can be activated in just a moment's notice. What's that? Yeah, fibrinogen, for instance. Okay, so you already know angiotensinogen. I didn't really need to describe that. And this signal, this renin signal from the kidney, can convert angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1, which is kind of like a pre-hormone to angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 1 is converted into angiotensin 2 by this converting enzyme called ACE. And guess what that stands for? Angiotensin converting enzyme, ACE. And you've probably heard of ACE already, some of you. Okay? And angiotensin 2 is really the active form of angiotensinogen. Where we find ACE is a little bit in the liver, but the lungs. ACE is an enzyme that we find in the lungs. So the lungs convert angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. Now let's look and see what the effect of angiotensin 2 is in the body. It goes to the adrenal cortex, and just like on the previous slide, we see that it causes secretion of aldosterone, which then helps you retain salt and water because it has an effect on the kidney. And as you retain water, what happens to the blood volume? It goes up. And then the heart gets stronger, typically, okay, unless you're on the descending limb of that Frank Starling curve. And cardiac output goes up. And what's going to happen to blood pressure? It's going to increase. Right? So this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, okay, I want you to say what effect it has on blood pressure. When it's operating, okay, what's the effect on blood pressure? It increases blood pressure. Okay, angiotensin 2 also has a direct effect on some blood vessels, and it has a vasoconstriction effect on arterioles. And if we constrict an arteriole, okay, if we constrict an arteriole, what happens to resistance? It increases, right? Okay, so if it increases, in order to make blood flow constant in your body, what has to happen to pressure? If blood flow is constant and we increase R, what has to happen to P? P has to go up the same amount to maintain blood flow the same. Okay, so vasoconstriction of arterioles increases blood pressure. All right, and that's all a result of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. This is the most important mechanism for controlling long-term blood pressure in people. And I kind of call it the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. You're going to have to look at it a couple times before you're familiar with it. But it's so important because this is the most important mechanism for regulating your blood pressure from day to day and from month to month. And what did I just say is epidemic in the United States, maybe the world? Hypertension. So here we see a nice complicated mechanism with a bunch of steps, but I think that's pretty cool because we can develop drugs, right, different drug therapies to interact at each one of these steps right here, and what can we control? Help control blood pressure, right? Okay, so to increase blood pressure, you need ACE. Oh, it says right here, most important system for long-term regulation of blood pressure. Hypertension can be managed by doing what to blood volume? Yeah, taking diuretics, decreasing blood volume by taking diuretics. That's usually the first line of treatment. A person can also be prescribed ACE inhibitors because what does ACE do? ACE increases angiotensin 2, which increases blood pressure through this mechanism right here. So if we keep the formation of angiotensin 2 or stop the formation of angiotensin 2, what's that going to do to blood pressure? That's going to have a tendency to decrease it. Okay. ARBs, angiotensin 2 receptor blockers. All right. These, where does angiotensin 2 have an effect? On arterioles and also on the adrenal cortex, right? And it's going to influence blood pressure in which way? If we can block angiotensin receptors, then we block the binding of angiotensin to its receptor so it has no effect. What's going to happen to blood pressure then? we see it's going to go down. And that's why this is really an important exam figure for you, right? So if you have this like burned into your memory, then you can understand what the action is of some of these pharmaceutical agents. Beta blockers, ooh, what kind of beta blocker? Two or one? Well, what kind of beta receptors does the heart have? This is from just a couple of weeks ago, because this is a really short semester, maybe it flashed by so fast. Yeah, it has beta one, right? Beta two are in the lungs. Okay, so we would like nice selective beta 1 blockers, because we don't want to block the beta receptors in the lungs or alpha receptors in other parts of the body. Okay, and if that will slow the heart rate down. Okay, so beta blockers really doesn't affect this system here, but has a direct effect on the heart by slowing it down. Calcium channel blockers. Okay, again, that's going to affect contractility. If we take calcium out of the heart, what about the sliding of myofilaments, okay, and even excitation of the heart. That's all going to be blunted as a result, okay. And here's one that we're not going to understand the mechanism of, but here is an alpha-2 agonist. These are central receptors in the brain, and these will decrease blood pressure. A good example of this is going to be clonidine, and it has a very fast effect. Some of these, like ACE inhibitors and ARBs, and maybe even Lasix, okay, well, not so much Lasix, but ACE inhibitors and ARBs take a number of days or weeks to really exhibit their true effect. All right, and if somebody has high blood pressure, what was normal blood pressure once again? 120 over 80. If a patient comes into emergency room and their blood pressure is 210 over 150, the pressure in their arteries is really high, what could happen to that artery? Oh, it could just pop at any second. So what would you like to do for blood pressure then? Decrease it, you know, do you have a couple days or weeks to adjust it, or what would you like to do? How about in a couple minutes, right? Because that blood vessel could pop someplace in your body. That's what clonidine usually is used for. It will have an immediate effect. And you can imagine when something has an immediate effect on blood pressure like that, you probably feel really miserable. But what does it do? It saves your life. Some patients are on clonidine consistently for long periods of time because some of these other medications don't work. All right, so if you have any family members that have hypertension, all right, you really got to help them get these different pharmaceuticals adjusted in their blood. And usually, okay, if you just give one, like Lasix or an ACE inhibitor, that's not enough to get blood pressure down because of negative feedback mechanisms then that counteract the drug that you're giving them. So usually you have to wreck this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system in a couple of these steps right here. Usually you have to take, what, a diuretic and an ACE inhibitor, or a diuretic and an ARB. And that doesn't really happen overnight, okay? And you just have to help people become compliant with that, and they have to work with their doctor. It might even take a year to get normal blood pressure. You know, unless it's really, really high, then what? Alpha-2 agonists, all right, if that's the case. All right, so, but why do you want to control blood pressure? We just gave one example, because it can produce aneurysms and strokes and things like that, but it also will kill the heart, right? So it's really deadly. It's deadly on the kidney, it's deadly on the heart, deadly on the brain. So you just have to help anybody you know with high blood pressure to get that all under control. All right, so what hormones have we talked about already? Antidiuretic hormone, this is a good slide right here. What's the effect on blood pressure of antidiuretic hormone? Increases, what happened? I went up one. Okay, so ADH increases blood pressure. What about aldosterone? Increases blood pressure. So what does that do for hypertension? Yeah, it exacerbates the condition, makes it worse. Both of these hormones make it worse. So some we'd like to mess with aldosterone, that renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, to help reduce blood pressure in somebody that has hypertension. Okay, here is the third hormone, atrial natriuretic hormone. It's released by the atrium. Now, where the heck is that located? Where's an atrium located? What organ? The heart, yeah, it's located in the heart. So your heart helps regulate blood pressure because of this reflex, and it's an endocrine reflex. And natriuretic, you know what uretic means, that has something to do with kidneys and urine formation. What about natrium? What does that stand for? Sodium. So this is a hormone that will adjust sodium concentration in the body. That's what that natriuretic means. All right, so let me flip to atrial natri uretic. Your book calls it atrial natri uretic peptide, ANP. I don't really care what you call it, but I call it a hormone because it's a hormone. Okay, expanded blood volume is detected because when you have large blood volume, you have more venous return to the heart. And as more blood returns to the heart, what happens to the filling of an atrium? It increases, it stretches an atrium, and under those conditions, then atrial natri uretic hormone is released into the body. All right, and ANP inhibits aldosterone. So what's that? Is that synergistic or antagonistic? Antagonistic, sure. All right, promotes salt and water excretion, all right, by the kidney. What does that do to blood volume? If you excrete water in the urine, as well as salt, that decreases blood volume. And what's the effect on blood pressure then? It's going to decrease blood pressure as a result, right? Promotes vasodilation. Well, what did we say about vasoconstriction? If blood vessels vasoconstrict, what happens to blood pressure? We said it increases. So if we vasodilate, what does that do to blood pressure? Decreases. So the bottom line on this slide is that we can see that atrial natri uretic hormone is antagonistic to both ADH and aldosterone. Okay, so, and thank goodness, there's something that is. All right, so atrial natri uretic hormone together with decreased ADH acts in a negative feedback system to lower blood volume and help control blood pressure. All right, so if we have increased blood pressure, that could be the stimulus that increases venous return, that increases stretch of the atrium, and when the atrium is stretched, what's the name of the hormone that it secretes? Atrial natri uretic hormone, or you could call it peptide. Okay, that also sends signals to the brain. The vagus nerve goes to the brain. The brain hypothalamus tells the posterior pituitary to decrease the amount of antidiuretic hormone that it is secreting. And what's the effect of ADH on blood pressure? You don't have to think of the whole mechanism, but we wrote it down as a little synopsis. As ADH increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases because it's directly related. So if we take ADH away, okay, what happens if we take ADH away? What then would you expect for blood pressure? Yeah, it's got to decrease, the opposite effect. Okay, so let's carry on. The effect is going to work through the kidneys. So you should appreciate how important the kidneys are for long-term regulation of blood pressure. All right, so when there is hypertension, all right, or increased blood pressure, if all these systems are working properly, right, increased atrial natri uretic protein, decreased ADH, it's going to have an effect on the kidney to increase urine volume. All right, and what's going to happen to blood volume when we increase? Yeah, so we're going to produce copious amounts of dilute urine. That's going to decrease blood volume, and then that's going to feed back to venous return. Okay, and what's that going to do for blood pressure? That will decrease blood pressure. All right, so here is a nice negative feedback mechanism for decreasing blood pressure, and we looked at the other two for increasing blood pressure. Let me see what I want to say about vascular resistance to blood flow. All right, I think over the weekend you should review Poiseuille's law. Okay, and Poiseuille's law is just an expansion of this real simple equation right here. Blood flow is directly related to pressure, inversely related to resistance. You should appreciate what are some properties of your body that can control this resistance term. And I think from lab you would know. What can adjust or regulate resistance or has an effect on resistance in your body in terms of blood vessels? How about if you have a short tube compared to a long tube? Is that going to affect flow through that tube? Absolutely. Okay, so, and what do we call that? Length. Okay, the length of a blood vessel will affect resistance. What else can affect resistance? Let's pump water through that tube. And then let's pump some maple syrup, because I like maple syrup. Okay, so viscosity is another important term that's going to increase resistance. And what's another one? And I saved the best for last. And that is the radius of a blood vessel, or that measures the amount of vasoconstriction or vasodilation. And that's the most important because why? because it's not just the resistance. I mean, it's just not the radius. Sorry, just not the radius. It's the radius times the radius times the radius times the radius, right? It's radius to the fourth power. So small changes in radius make huge changes in resistance, which then make huge changes in blood flow in various parts of your body. All right, so we're going to start someplace over here next time. Factors affecting blood flow. So at least memorize your cardiac output equation, your blood flow equation, and review Poiseuille's equation. And the sign-in sheet is going around someplace.